Welcome to the Drive Along Podcast, where in each episode I interview a guest uniquely involved in the car culture universe.
So welcome everyone, and with me today is Nader Ansari. He's a partner in Eclection Automotive. Nader, welcome to Drive Along.
Thank you, Ron. Pleasure to be here.
Nader, you have quite a collection of eclectic cars, and possibly that's the reason for the partial name or the company. We've met before, and I've seen a few of the cars, and you've been kind enough to release them to be shown at one of my car shows, the Burlington Car Show. How did you get started in car collecting?
Well, I've been married just over 26 years, so it started about 27 years ago when my wife-to-be and I went to visit school friends of mine in Vancouver. While we were there, we went for a stroll in North Vancouver in the industrial area where there's a lot of used car dealerships, and one of them was Salish Auto House. When we walked by there, we saw three Mercedes Pontons, 1950s vintage. They were all 180s. I was very intrigued by them, and I suggested we come back for another romantic walk when the dealership was open and have a look at the cars.
Oh, you smooth talker.
Well, yes. I wasn't on the I wasn't in the net yet. or on the boat. So we went to have a look, and there was an elderly German fellow who'd worked with Mercedes in Germany and had immigrated to Canada. I asked him, well, do any of them run? And he was quite offended and said, of course they all run. They're all in excellent condition. So we continued and we went for a test drive. It was four in the tree. It drove very well. The springing on that car is legendary. There was a brown one, a black one, and a repainted beige one, which was actually kind of yucky military blue underneath. And when we renovated it or restored it, we brought it back to blue, although it was a metallic Ferrari blue is what it sports now. It was imported by a German shipping company, and the fellow was under the impression that these cars fetched a lot more money in Canada than they did in Germany. So when he came over with his ocean liner, he used the car, I don't know for how long, weeks or months, while he was in Vancouver before he returned. And then he thought he would sell it for a pretty penny, and he was disappointed to see that it didn't have that much value. So that's the car that the dealer suggested we buy. And I was hemming and hawing. He wanted the extortionate sum of $7,500. And I said, well, how about $5,000? And I said, how do I know if it'll make it across the country? And he said, if it doesn't make it across the country without problems, I will come pick it up and take it back. So we settled for $5,500, but still in our collection. We left Vancouver and our friends were literally, we found out later, losing sleep until we let them know we'd arrived safely in Ontario. It's about a 46-hour drive. They were worried the car would not make it. It was a lovely ride. The springing was fantastic, especially in northern Ontario, those wide, sweeping curves. So it was a delightful ride. The only problem we had was we had too much of the electrics going one day and sunk the battery. But once the battery was recharged, there was no issue. The car ran with a generator, so it didn't have an alternator. So long as you could get the car started, you could keep running. It would create enough power.
Yes, of course it would. What a great story. 27 years later, you still own the car. That's one in your collection.
Yes, and I'm still married.
Well, it was the right move then, wasn't it?
Absolutely. That's a good way to determine if you're a match.
Absolutely. That are approximately, how many cars do you have in your collection now?
Well, between my sort of personal collection and the collection, the business, I think we're at around somewhere around 50 cars.
That's huge. What's your criteria? We talked before we got into this about quirkiness. The one of the cars particularly that you brought to the car show one year was a BMW Isetta, which very, very few people, I was over the moon seeing it, but there were so few people that knew what it was. All day long, there's crowds around it where we parked it, all day long, because it's so unique. And one of the other vehicles that I know you have is Japanese Rolls Royce, for lack of a different way of putting it, the Toyota Century.
That's correct.
Now I've learned about the Mercedes 180, I know about the Isetta, I know about the Century. These are not your typical American muscle cars, shall we say, that you're going after.
Correct. Well, my first car, which could be called an American muscle car, was a 72 Oldsmobile, which I bought from my mother. It had a 455 engine, so it was a tremendously powerful engine, but it was moving so much weight, it was far from a sports car. It took a long time to get up to speed and then a long time to slow it down.
Yeah.
Typically, my focus really started with German cars. I have my mother's German. I got a lot of exposure to German cars. I rode in an Isetta when I was probably 7 years old in Germany, and it's a very funky car. It was started by an Italian fridge manufacturer, got into automotive, hence the reason it has what would resemble a fridge door with a handle on the front of it, which is the only door, and the escape hatch is the canvas roof. In case you get into an accident, obviously you can't open the door to get out. You have to go through the roof.
You know, I knew it was initially penned by an Italian, but I did not realize they were a fridge manufacturer. So I just learned something about that front door.
So one of the common sort of themes in early collecting was cars that helped Germany get out of the sort of post-war recession, and the vehicles that turned those companies around. Well, the Isetta was one that really allowed BMW to leverage its pre-war technology, which is basically there's a motorcycle engine in the Isetta. It's a one-cylinder. Originally, it had three wheels to start, because why would you need the extra fourth wheel? That's just waste. Why would you need more than one cylinder? It's not necessary. Why would you need more than one door? So just the absolute minimalism and that sort of economy. You know, the shifter is right up against the wall. Very clever, minimalistic use. I call it the original smart car. It was from that era of miniature cars, and some of them are just the most delightful cars to collect. The one beauty of BMW is that you can still service it. Some of the cars, like the Messerschmitts and things like that, they're just, you know, I would be concerned just finding parts for them to keep them going.
Yeah, you'd be fabricating things.
I didn't mention that I will only buy cars that are drivers, showpieces for antiques. I believe cars need to be driven. Obviously, if they're of such tremendous value, like a partner and I went in on a 356 Porsche twin grille roadster. Once it got delivered, we realized how pristine it was. It was just basically too pristine to drive. Every time you drove it, it would cost in terms of its value.
Mm-hmm.
So much that, you know, we were just worried to drive it. I sold out of that car, sort of the museum cars. I don't really have an interest. I want to be able to get in the car. All the cars that I would have would all be mechanically operable. So I can get in, turn the ignition, and enjoy the car or the experience of the car. Sometimes you don't necessarily enjoy the experience, but it's an experience nonetheless of, you know, what was it like, say, 20, 30, 50 60 years ago to drive a car, things like having to double clutch to get to the next gear. Is it on the tree? Is it on the floor? Is it pushing the gear shifter in and out like the Citroën 2CV? These quirky characteristics of different cars, be it an Italian car, a German car, a French car, a Japanese car, they all have these very different personalities and quirks. Even the Isetta, you literally have to make it smoother. And for me, a car it's got to be standard, or you're really losing your connection with the car. Not that all the cars I have are standard. There's such a sort of connection with the mechanics. So on the Isetta, for instance, if you want to shift into second gear, make it smoother, you try to match the engine speed with the rear wheels. the rolling speed, and then you make a very smooth transition.
But you know, that fully understanding the vehicle, in racing school back, I guess, in the 80s, Corvettes at Mossport, on the third day of the school, that's what they had you do. Come out of turn five, and then you were to shift all the way up to turn eight without touching the clutch.
Right.
So just to get a much better understanding and feel for the car and that meshing.
Absolutely. And the joy I learned on the first car, it had a funky part on the underside of the car where the clutch would go. Went on me, I think, three times. So I remember having to drive up Yonge Street in Toronto without a clutch. So, so that was quite a interesting endeavor where I would have to keep, when I hit a red light or a stop sign, I would have to turn the car off, start it up in second, and then nurse my way up to my mechanic shop in Woodbridge. And I didn't have to do that again for almost 20 years until I had the same problem with Alfa Romeo GTV, the James Bond car, wherein Ingersoll, which is about 100 kilometers out of Toronto, it transmission gave up, the clutch gave up. So I had to shift without a clutch. And I had memories of the Mercedes from 20 years earlier. How did I do this again? And it's a lot of fun when you get it.
Well, it feels so good when you get it. And yes. You really cringe when you don't.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned DeChavaux is also in your collection.
That's right. That's a recent addition. Lovely car. It just landed. I think it's about 30,000 kilometers only.
Oh my God.
It's pristine. Just lovely. You know, it's one of these cars. It was a people's car, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I think the mandate to the designers was that you'd have to be able to carry a basket of eggs through a farmer's field without breaking any eggs, which is, you know, just a delightful story. Myth or fact, I don't know, but these myths around things are often as interesting as facts would be. Like with the Beetle, the mandate to Porsche was that it would have to be able to travel all day at 100 kilometers per hour, carry around a family of four, and come in at under 1,000 D-marks or Deutsche Marks of the time. And Porsche said, I can do all of that, but get it under 1,000 Deutsche Marks. And the order was, well, that's unacceptable till you bring it under 1,000 Deutsche Marks. So that was the really challenging part for him.
But clearly.
The innovation.
What else is in the collection? I mean, I've now heard of Alfa Romeo, the DeChavaux, the first Mercedes. What other interesting or industry trend icons? I would call both the Zeta and the DeChavaux or DeChavaux industry trends. You've sort of identified, you know, the people's vehicles, whether it's the Volkswagen or the other two. What else do you have?
One of my partners with whom I bought two very fancy 356s. He and I both agree that, you know, you need to have a 356 in your garage as a starting point. And so I have a 356B coupe, hardtop coupe, 1963. It's a B model. It's an absolute delight. You know, it's a 1963. It holds its own on a modern highway. It's just a beautiful car. No concerns from a safety perspective, aside from there's no airbags and, you know, the seatbelts are subpar. But in terms of the handling on a road and holding a road, the experience is just lovely. The air-cooled engine, the sound of an air-cooled engine, it's just heartwarming.
That's true. It can't be beat.
Right. I mean, my wife's had many years of me slowing down when a Beetle or a 356 is nearby or any air-cooled engine rolling down the window and then sort of, you know, keeping pace with that vehicle. The feeling is the visceral. It's an escape feeling. You get transported somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely right. I can't wait to share this podcast with my boys who are now grown men, but they grew up with Dad catching up to a 356 or a mid-60s Ferrari, and the windows go down, and you try and follow them along without being obtrusive to them.
Right. So
That's what my family grew up with.
So an interesting car while we're on it is a late 60s, I think a 69 Beetle, which was called the automatic stick shift.
Oh, yeah.
The automatic stick, which mm-hmm. was a car that was, it was sold, it was Housewives at the time was the marketing. And because there was this fear of, well, if you're driving a manual transmission, your left calf will become too muscular and that would be unappealing. That was one of their ads. They had a lot of very cheeky ads in the 60s at VW. And so the clutch is on a solenoid on the stick. So when you go to move the stick, the clutch engages, then you change the gear. And when you release the gear shift, the clutch engages again and you drive. So it's literally a manual car, but you don't need the pedal. You don't need your left foot to change the gear. And it's a lovely driver. The compromise is you basically lose a gear and you lose the ability to move quickly. But the mechanism, as I say, that's over 50 years old. It still works well, and it's a lovely driver.
That's fantastic. And what a good engineering technology to be able to come up with a car with a clutch without a clutch pedal. Mm-hmm. And talk about Volkswagen quirky commercials or interesting commercials. I had the opportunity a bunch of years ago now to do some work with Volkswagen, and we put a satellite channel together for them. And it gave me access to the archives of their old commercials. And I remember that one. And the other one that has always stuck with me is there's this young, barely more than a teenager, MC. Of course, the commercial is black and white. And he's talking about the engine in the back. It's a station wagon. I cannot for the life of me remember the model. Volkswagen station wagon.
Type 3,
He's looking in the back. And he said, and there's an engine in the back, and you still have all this cargo room. And no, look in the back, and you have all this cargo room. And then you go to the front, and there's more cargo room.
Exactly.
And the little bouncy actor, MC, that they had for it was none other than Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that was the Doyle Dane Dernbach advertisements they had.
Right.
Like it's big on the outside, small on the outside, big on the inside. What car does the snowplow driver drive to get to his snowplow? Those cars, well, my parents, when they immigrated to Canada in 64, that was their first car. My mother actually had that car in Germany. She drove that car to the Middle East where she lived with my father. Mm-hmm. When they came here, the first car they bought was a Beetle, and then later on a Fastback. And I believe there was a Type 4 as well, the station wagon.
Topical that I remember that commercial then. You've got a lot of unique cars in your collection. You talk about them all passionately, and everyone has a unique quality to it. Do you have a favorite?
I think the favorite depends on my mood and the day. If I want to have, say, you mentioned the Toyota Century, which is just a lovely car. So if I feel like smoothness, luxury, I will get my son. My son and daughter have both developed an appetite for enjoying quirky, interesting vintage cars. And I will just have my son drive me. I'll get into the back seat passenger side, which is the left side of the car, part of the seat in the front that folds down. You can put your legs through. You can literally tilt the seat a little bit and almost lie down. Enjoy the stereo system and the smooth ride between the cabin and the suspension. And they've got a special contact tires that are like super smooth. You're just kind of gliding along. Mm-hmm. And then if I want to have a more quirky experience, I'll get into the Isetta, which has four gears. Four forward gears and a reverse. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not with it and I'm not in tune with the mechanism, I'm going to miss a shift and it's going to grumble back at me. Similar on the Mercedes. If you don't synchronize the engine speed with the rolling speed, the tire speed well enough, you'll get feedback.
Yeah.
And when you get it right, it's just, it's lovely. Then my favorite car on the track, and it's not a monster, but it's a 1987 Porsche 928, which is, I understand it's the only car that's, you know, a MoMA award in terms of its design. It's the one that looks like a shark on the front. The bumpers are concealed underneath the outside. It's just a lovely shape. Mm-hmm. It is a wonderful vehicle on the track. Most port being my favorite track in these areas.
Yeah.
Obviously on the straightaway, any of the modern cars leave me behind, but it really holds its own in the corners. It's an absolute delight. The balance, the front, back, side balance. It's just a lovely experience.
And that would be a track to be able to really find that out. Motorsport's a beautiful track because the back straight and the big engines will just blow by you. But I can remember back to the Trans Am days in the early 70s when Penske had the Camaros. They would go blasting around and be, you know, the back straight ahead of the Mini Coopers. But by the time we got back to corner five, the Mini Coopers were right on their bumper again.
Yeah, the Mini Cooper, we've got two of those. One is 15,000 kilometers, showroom condition. It's just an absolute lovely car.
And that's it's brand new.
30 years old. They hold the road very well.
Little go-karts.
Mm-hmm.
I know that these cars just don't come from Ontario or Canada or even North America for that matter. What's your most interesting time acquiring a car, like hunting one down or a particular one that you're after? And
well, that's difficult. I'd say the one that I'm on the prowl for now, which is a Cosmo, which is great for a podcast. You can't see this, but
yeah, appreciate that.
Hopefully one is as mint condition as this one inside the box. It's absolutely brilliant. I've seen in Japan, I've seen a couple of them. Looked at a number of them in number of collectors that have them, mm-hmm. but their collections come very close to buying one. Haven't yet. Saw one a couple of weeks ago. I think I've been looking for about 3 years for this one. One of the things I would share with people is be patient. My advice is don't try to buy a cheap car. Try to buy a really good car. Getting a car for a really good price that needs a lot of restoration, I will tell you, you will always spend more on the restoration than if you pay for somebody else's car after they've done the restoration, because it does not, 90 times out of 100 does not stay, you know, you lose value on it.
Mm-hmm.
With the one exception being you should do it at least once in your lifetime. So pick a cheap car like a VW Beetle to do it. Unless it's truly a labor of love and you're going to do a lot of the work yourself, I would always argue, have a look with a collector who's looked after it with love or had it in the family, where that work has been done ahead of time or where it's as original as possible. Like if you get a car like some of the ones we found at like less than 20,000 kilometers, you know, there's going to be some bugs that need to be straightened out. You're going to have to do some mechanical, you know, sprucing up or restoration, but it's a fraction of what it would be if you do it. So that would be my advice to everybody. Buy as much car as you have the money for. If you don't have enough money to get a good model, well, Rolls-Royce, then try to get the best VW Beetle you can and then enjoy it.
Very wise words. You're a driver. Anyone that's listened to the podcast to this point will recognize that. Personal driving experience. Where, when, driving what? What's something in your long memory of these fantastic vehicles, or indeed another vehicle, but just a particular drive that just still really sticks in your mind?
Well, the drive we had across the country obviously was a hell of a drive. I often tell people that Mexico City, Lima, Peru, in a VW Beetle, there's nothing like it. Nothing like it. The chaos, lack of attention to rules of the road, a free-for-all when you go into the roundabouts. You've got a jockey for position with 10, 20, 50 other cars and try to come out. It's like a slow race that you're doing with way too many cars, with not enough real estate on the track. It's a lot of communication with the other drivers. You have to establish the etiquette of where you are. My wife's Peruvian. Her relatives will not drive certain parts of the city. I say, bring it on. Let's go. There's one I call, they call roundabouts óvalos, and I call this one the roundabout of death. You never know. And there's a bypass. They put a tunnel in that goes underneath the whole óvalo, they call it. And I say, no way I'm going through the tunnel. It's just a straight right-of-way tunnel. We're going to go through the oval and fight with all the omnibuses and all the other cars in various states of repair, make our way around.
You're a true driver. I was expecting a 356 on the Corniche going into from Nice to Monte Carlo or something, and I get a roundabout in Peru. I love it. A real driver. We've already touched on it, but acquisitions on the horizon. I guess the one you've got your crosshairs on now is the Cosmo. Is the Cosmo the name of the manufacturer, or is it a model by a manufacturer?
It's a model by a manufacturer. It's the predecessor to the Mazda RX-8, 7, etc. It's the Wankel engine, the rotary engine.
That would be a very unique car. I've raced the rotary engine on an RX-7. It's a unique experience itself.
Well, I love the smoothness of those engines.
Nader, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate your time today. Your knowledge and depth of knowledge is phenomenal. I'm glad to hear that you're a partner in Eclection Automotive, because that means other people may have an opportunity to acquire and share some of the vehicles that you've collected over the years, and maybe pick your brain a little bit on some of the background on those vehicles.
Absolutely. So I think there was some, when my colleague and I were talking in terms of what vehicle would you never sell or let go of, I would say I look at vehicles as children, shall we say, and parting with them as a sort of adoption proceedings. So if somebody could convince me they're not going to take a car to a demolition derby and they're going to show it the kind of love, well, what comes to mind is when we showed the Isetta in your show on the Burlington show, and there was a lady from Chile, and you told me how people were swarming the car. I came at the end of the day to collect the car, and there was still a swarm around the car, and one of the ladies said, oh, can I please get my picture taken inside the car? And I said, okay. She was, I would guess, in her 70s. And she said, I had one of these cars when I was in university. It was an absolutely phenomenal car. I took it up into the mountains on weekends, and I had a great time. The only problem I ever had with it was when my colleagues from university would pick it up and put it in a flower bed, and then I couldn't drive it out. I'd need to get three friends or four friends to pick it up. It's about a 600-pound car that I would be stuck. And she said, would you contemplate selling it? And my answer is to you, yes. If you've got a story like that, by all means, adoption is always an option.
Oh, I like that. I like that phrase. Adoption is an option. I understand. Not to anyone, but someone that appreciates what it is. Nader, thank you very much.